Today, I'm going to talk about the sense of smell and the brain. I really learned a lot doing the reporting for this episode, including the fact that the sense of smell is more directly tied to the brain and memory centers than our other senses are. And there's a connection between the loss of sense of smell and Alzheimer's disease. As a lot of people know, there's also a connection between COVID-19 and a loss of sense of smell. How does this all tie together? That's what's on tap for today's episode of Follow the Science, an exploration of science, medicine, and medical misinformation. I'm your host, Faye Flam. I'm a science journalist and a Bloomberg opinion columnist, and this podcast grew out of a fellowship from the Society for Professional Journalists. My guest is Mark Albers. He's a neurologist who studies Alzheimer's disease at Massachusetts General Hospital, and he developed something called a smell memory test that actually can pick up signs of Alzheimer's disease early. And in recent weeks, he's been working with COVID patients trying to understand why they so often lose their sense of smell and what that means. We start off by talking about a study that was published in the journal Nature, one that got a lot of attention in the media. Researchers compared brain scans of people before and after getting COVID. They were able to do this because a group of people had volunteered to have scans taken before the pandemic as part of a data gathering project. And so the researchers were able to call volunteers to come back and to find out whether or not they'd tested positive for COVID in the meantime. And the results showed that there were some subtle changes in areas of the brain controlling the sense of smell and memory. I'd done some reporting on this study for a column I wrote for Bloomberg, and I discovered that the results are not quite as scary as they sound. The doctors I interviewed said that the changes were actually too small to be picked up by a radiologist, and they were detected in the study only by averaging lots of different scans together. And it's also not clear that they had any impact or caused any symptoms for the subjects, or whether they're likely to persist. But the fact that the changes were in the smell center was interesting to Dr. Albers. Maybe we could start with this Nature study because people are so, I think people are a little alarmed by the idea that having had COVID might change your brain in this way. And it also looked like the changes were in parts of the brain that govern the sense of smell.
Well, I think there's many different takeaways. Just to give you a little background on myself, I'm a neurologist and I see patients at the memory clinic here at Mass General Hospital in Boston, as well as people with smell disorders from a neurologic perspective. And the COVID virus, SARS-CoV-2, has offered us a unique perspective. For the patients who've been infected by SARS-CoV-2, the virus itself elicits a very strong inflammatory response in the back of the nose, the nasal epithelium. And it is controversial about whether the virus gets into the brain itself. In my view, the evidence supporting the virus getting into the brain is quite limited. But what is clear from work that we've done in animal models here is that the inflammation that a virus can generate in the nose, the inflammation can spread into the brain.
I know there was an autopsy study that got a lot of press where they said they found viral RNA in the brain and other places. And yet, I don't know whether that would necessarily indicate the virus had gotten around to the brain and these other parts of the body, or whether it was sort of portrayed that way in the press.
Yeah, I mean, so there's been a number of studies that have looked at this. When you're detecting RNA, there are extremely sensitive methods to do that. And the receptor for the virus is in blood vessels. And so one has to be careful that they're not detecting viruses in blood vessels, but that is not in the brain. And yet, as you're seeing fulminant effects on the olfactory system and in the patients with long COVID, fulminant effects in their neurologic function. And so it's clearly the sparse representation, if it's even true, it would be hard to understand how that could cause these profound clinical symptoms, which, you know, the patients are suffering and it really impacts their life. And so I think the studies like this in the UK and other studies that identify mechanisms and hopefully that lead to treatments will, you know, are very exciting.
Why would there be so much inflammation in the brain if the virus isn't getting up there?
So the pathways between, you know, again, we're just talking about the olfactory part of the brain now, not the entire brain. There's evidence that inflammation in the nose can track, you know, along where the nerve cells in the nose that recognize odors also project through the skull into the brain, where they connect in the brain to pass along that olfactory information. And along those pathways, there's an anatomical connection, and the inflammatory mediators can also pass along that pathway. And that we've shown in mouse models where we mimic a viral infection. There's no virus, and yet we see the same inflammatory response in the brain as we do in the nose, in the olfactory regions. And so, you know, with that, then you can see that inflammation begets more inflammation.
Wow, that's so interesting. And so, you know, anecdotally, it seems like a lot of people who have had COVID lose their sense of smell for quite a long time after they've recovered, whether they even consider themselves people with long COVID. I know some friends who don't think they have long COVID, but they will say, yeah, I still can't smell anything. So it seems like it's pretty common. What do we know about the loss of sense of smell and how long it can hang on after people recover?
In COVID, there's, I think, three different types of patients that I've seen in the clinic. Some that lose their sense of smell profoundly early in the course, but then they will regain that sense of smell within days to weeks. And a lot of them will fully regain that sense of smell. Now, the longer the patients that lose their sense of smell for a much longer period of time, I think there seems to be some damage to the nerve cells themselves, and that may also be inflammatory mediated. Again, we don't have evidence that the virus itself is infecting and killing all the nerve cells in a given patient. It's quite rare. So it seems to be the inflammation that might be doing that. And so those patients then are looking more like these post-viral anosmics, where it takes months to years to come back. And then some, you know, it's too early, but some may never regain their sense of smell. And that suggests that the stem cells, so in the nose, it's one of the few places where there's actually stem cells that can regenerate neurons or regenerate nerve cells. The third class of patients with COVID will regain their sense of smell over a long period of time, but it will be distorted. The medical term is parosmia, but it's a very distorted sense of smell. And in those patients, I think what's happening is that we have memories. The olfactory system is very tightly coupled to the memory system. So we have memories of what we think things used to smell like. And if you then regain olfactory function, but it does not meet your expectation, the perception does not meet the expectation, what your memory was, it can be quite distorted. And so that distortion then is actually quite troubling and quite disabling for the patients who are suffering it. I think COVID has made us all appreciate the patients who've lost their sense of smell, how important smell is in quality of life. And then the patients who have this distorted sense of smell, where it's quite unpleasant, it really impacts their sense. You know, it's one thing is loss. Another thing is, you know, where it's an added unpleasant perception that there's no escape from it. It's quite a debilitating situation.
I would assume that there's an evolutionary reason why we experience certain smells as bad if there's something that would be harmful, especially when it comes to food, that our sense of smell tells us this isn't food or this has been spoiled and this food is edible. That's a really sort of important guide for humans and other animals to know whether something is edible. And so does the distortion interfere with that? So things that should smell good to them smell bad?
So in the patients with parosmias, all odors will smell bad, will smell distorted and have a very unpleasant emotion. It's very hard for the patients to describe the odor. I've had from rotten garbage to rotten fish, but it's not exactly that. But the, you know, the best descriptor is in that category where it's very unpleasant, but in quite consistent. So in other words, a number of different odors, say coffee, a rose, and some fruit could elicit the same type of very unpleasant perception in suggesting that the way that the circuit is wired is it just detects them all as if they're not recognized and then unpleasant. And even the rotten fish, it's not really like a particular fish that's gone bad. It's just kind of, it reminds them of that unpleasant feeling that you can experience with rotten fish, but not necessarily exactly rotten fish, you know?
So, I think a lot of people now know about the role of smell in COVID, but don't know that there's a connection between the sense of smell and Alzheimer's disease. So I would love to hear what that connection is and what you've been able to learn about it.
Sure. So the sense of smell is unique because the second order neurons, so in the network, you know, the detector cells connect with cells in the brain, and then those cells directly connect into the memory system. And so there's a unique connection between smell and memory. And
more so than the other senses.
More so than the other senses.
Interesting. So what you hear, what you see, those are processed in a different way to become memories.
To become memories. Exactly. Yes.
Here I start talking about the hippocampus, which is the part of the brain that encodes memory. And Dr. Albers says that smell is actually wired more directly into the hippocampus and therefore the memory centers than any of our other senses. Somehow, because it's connected to the hippocampus, or the smell center is part of the hippocampus, or
so
how does that work?
Yeah, so anatomically, it's closer to the hippocampus. But I think more importantly is just the way that the circuit is wired. It's just two connections away and you're into the memory centers of the brain. And that's unique compared to the other senses. The second is that, in my view, Alzheimer's disease is a disease that is smoldering in your brain for a decade, probably two decades, before it becomes symptomatic. And our brains fight back. There's compensatory ways that we fight against that disease as it's propagating and spreading in our brains. The olfactory circuits have less compensatory mechanisms available to them, less cells and less compensatory mechanisms. So it's more vulnerable. And what we see then is if we test memory, that's odor evoked memory, then we can pick up memory symptoms earlier. We're about ready to distribute a paper and submit it for publication that shows that it's 3.5 years before people get memory symptoms. We can detect memory impairments. So, and I think it's because that circuit is vulnerable. The other part that's very interesting is that the pathology of Alzheimer's disease, and particularly neurofibrillary tangles, the tangles are made up predominantly of tau protein, where they are located in the brain correlates with symptoms to a great deal. And the first places that tangles appear in people who are cognitively normal are the olfactory bulb, the first place where those odors are processed, and the entorhinal cortex, which is the gateway into the hippocampus. And so conducting odor memory studies, we're essentially pressing on the circuit that has two vulnerable spots, the first relay station and the second relay station. And I think that's why we can pick up memory symptoms earlier if we look for odor memory deficits.
Can you talk about how you measure odor memory? I'm really intrigued by that.
Sure. So we administer a set of smells and we ask the participant to smell an odor, They don't have any expectation about what they're going to smell. And then we ask them a question about the odor. For example, how intense is the odor, or are you familiar with the odor? And then we give them four choices, and we then ask them to identify the odor. What are the four names best describes the odor you just smelled? Then we wait 10 minutes, and then we have them smell the same odors again, but also it's twice as many, also new odors. So they smell the odor. Now the question is, did you smell this odor on the first test?
Wow. So they don't, the odor doesn't smell like anything familiar. So they don't just sort of remember, oh, I smelled peppermint. And then it's something different. So they have to remember that specific smell, not something that smells like something they remember.
What we've shown in the studies is that the familiarity does not affect their ability to remember it or not. So whether the person answers that it is familiar or not doesn't help them with memory. It does help them with identification. So if you're familiar with the odor, then when the four choices come up, you're more likely to answer that question correctly if you're familiar with the odor. But in terms of memory of the odor, it doesn't. And I think that's important because odors are so cultural that we, you know, will not have a battery of odors that's equally familiar to, you know, a population of individuals. But this finding appears to be independent of whether you're familiar or not. And it's quite different. It's not a way that we are used to using our brains. And so it's an interesting way to probe that circuit that is very vulnerable in early Alzheimer's disease.
Wow. And so do you think that that could lead to early treatments? And could that even be the sort of seat of treatment, that if that circuit is going, could that be the start of what you would try to fix in a treatment?
Yeah, I believe so. I believe that's the direction that we would like to head, is not only that, but the idea being, if we can detect the disease earlier, you know, before people are symptomatic, and then be able to conduct clinical trials in that window and ultimately start treating patients with disease modifying therapies in that window, that we'll have more success than if we wait until after the symptoms have developed.
At this point, I bring up one of the most common genetic associations with Alzheimer's disease. It's not an Alzheimer's gene per se, but it's a gene we all carry that comes in three types. It's called APOE. There is APOE 2, 3, and 4. And having one or two copies of the one labeled 4 seems to put people at increased risk. Does this loss of smell, does it correlate at all to other risk factors like the APOE4 gene?
Yes, it does. So we published that in 2016. There's an increase in those individuals that have a selective odor memory loss. They're enriched in the APOE4 gene. They already on MRIs, the memory area of the brain is already thinner. So there's already been some destruction in that area of the brain. And overall, in neuropsychological testing, memory for a story, they're still in the normal range, but they score lower on that test in general compared to people who have intact odor memory. And so it suggests that they're kind of on their way. And then this newer work that we'll be presenting next month at in the American Chemosensory Society meeting indicates that there's a clinical diagnosis that emerges about 3.5 years after that.
So, you know, I wonder if there are connections between any of these things. I mean, is there?
I'm very concerned. I'm very concerned. So the inflammation that we read about that's been evoked by the virus, COVID, SARS-CoV-2, overlaps quite a bit to the inflammation that we're seeing in some of the patients with Alzheimer's disease, in the autopsy brains of some of the patients with Alzheimer's disease, about 50% or so. And so I'm concerned that the inflammation that spills into the brain that might be responsible for, you know, the findings in this UK study, if somebody is already in a latent dementia case, then that could accelerate, that could fan the flames of that disease. And so speed up that time course such that the, you know, when we were saying before, where it's, it takes between 10 and 20 years for somebody to be symptomatic.
This part does seem a little worrisome, though, again, it doesn't imply that having had COVID will cause you to get Alzheimer's disease. But in some vulnerable people who are already progressing in that direction, Dr. Albers worries that it could accelerate things. Though, again, this isn't meant to panic people since COVID affects people in very different ways.
I'm concerned that we might see an increase in the number of diagnoses amongst people that were infected with SARS-CoV-2 in the next few years, because that time window will be shortened to the point of when symptoms develop. And it, in the UK study, I thought it was quite intriguing. It didn't get a lot of attention, but there's clearly, in my view, looking at the data, an age dependency to the findings in that study. And I think that it could mean, and again, it's a hypothesis, needs to be tested. I don't want to, you know, all of this needs research, but, and there's lots of efforts to do this kind of research to see if some of the findings that they represented that, or that were shown there connected with aging could be an intersection of the inflammation evoked by SARS-CoV-2 superimposed on pre-existing neuroinflammation from latent preclinical neurodegenerative disease.
Oh, so interesting. You know, one of the things that seemed sort of frustrating about that study was that it didn't look like they asked the subjects to report on whether they felt any long COVID symptoms. And I wondered if maybe they might have that data that just wasn't released in that paper.
Yeah, I'm it's a great group, and I know they're continuing to study it. So I'm and imagine they probably will. But I think it'll be fascinating to for them to follow that group and try to recruit more of their broader population so that they can address some of those questions.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of people I know who still have smell deficits but don't consider themselves long COVID victims, and whether there might even be people that don't have a normal sense of smell, but it hasn't bothered them too much, but there's something that you might detect that they are just are not aware of.
Absolutely. And that's exactly the kind of research we're doing right now. We've developed an at-home smell test to facilitate that kind of research so that people don't even have to come in. We can send them the cards in the mail and they can do this study at home. So I completely agree with you. And we're looking forward to getting the results from those kinds of studies.
Next up, I ask him about something I learned from talking to other neurologists. It turns out there's a hypothesis out there that infectious diseases can be linked to Alzheimer's. The thinking is that certain viruses and bacteria might trigger inflammation in the brain, and this could become destructive. One of the viruses that's been correlated with Alzheimer's is HSV-1. That's the herpes virus that gives people cold sores. It's extremely common and not understood at all why in a very few people it might have this effect on the brain. I wondered what you think of the hypothesis that viruses or other pathogens might be associated with Alzheimer's disease, maybe not as a root cause, but as a factor. Is that something that you think is likely to be the case?
So in general, there certainly is an emerging concern. I think as more and more we appreciate the role of inflammation in these neurodegenerative diseases, as well as in Alzheimer's specifically, then it does raise the question, what's the root cause of that inflammation? And in some cases, it could be contributed, not necessarily that it is a viral infection or an infection, but if people that do have infections could be, again, accelerate that timeline so that they become symptomatic more quickly. And there's strong epidemiologic evidence that people with cold sores, so herpes virus.
Right, the herpes simplex, yeah.
Have an increased risk of Alzheimer's disease. In very rare cases, the virus can reactivate and cause a very severe fulminant encephalitis that leads to severe cognitive deficits that are often not fully reversible after treatment. But I do wonder if there could be not that fulminant infection, but that some viruses like that, again, that could reactivate at a mild level, not cause any symptoms, but could fan the flames of the neuroinflammation that is present in these patients with Alzheimer's disease. There's also epidemiologic evidence that people with gum disease, so bacterial infections in the gums, have a higher risk of Alzheimer's disease. And again, that inflammation from those infections may be something that's fanning the flames of the inflammation that's going on within the brain.
Wow. Well, the gum disease, at least you could do something about it, right?
Exactly.
Herpes,
no, exactly.
You're stuck with it.
There's some preventive, you know, and I tell my patients that.
Yeah, you don't want to skip your dental cleanings.
Exactly. Because that might help too.
And to go back to SARS-CoV-2, knowing what you know now about the potential long-term effects, what do you think should be the response to that? Do you think that we just need more research, or we need to get a better vaccine or antivirals, or that maybe people should be more careful than they think, that we're more vulnerable than we realized?
We of course need better treatments for the virus, but the long COVID symptoms appear to be, you know, after the virus has cleared the body. And I think that we're, you know, dealing with inflammatory mechanisms. Abhi Nath was on a paper with one of my colleagues here at Mass General, Anna Louise Lowe-Oaklander, that were studying patients with long COVID and showed that there's a destruction in the small nerve fibers that control blood pressure, amongst other things. And that seems to be an immune mediated mechanism. They were able to diagnose it in Dr. Oaklander's lab by skin biopsies. So very small 3-millimeter punch biopsies, and looking at the nerves in the skin sample and seeing the destruction, with the idea that that's what's happening throughout the body. And those types of nerve destruction mediated by, in this case, antibodies, led to these kind of symptoms. And what was exciting is that they had some treatments for that in the patient seemed to respond.
I wondered if there's any information about whether Omicron actually doesn't affect the brain the same way, because it doesn't seem to rob people of their sense of smell the same way, or whether Omicron is still too new to know that.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think that we'll see some studies coming out on that in the near future. Again, if the sense of smell, I don't think it's a paradox, but it seems paradoxical at first, is in the first stages of COVID, if people lost their sense of smell, they were more likely to not have to go into the hospital. And conversely, the people who were having severe COVID, respiratory distress, requiring hospitalization, requiring intubation, they tended not to lose their sense of smell. And so it was a curious finding, but we hypothesized early that it's evidence that it's the inflammation that's driving the smell loss. And so for a person who's infected, they have a strong inflammatory response. They kill the virus. And so they have less risk of the virus getting into the lungs and causing this, you know, severe COVID symptoms. But because of that strong inflammatory response, they lose their sense of smell. And with Omicron, I think the studies will be interesting to see if it's the immune response elicited by Omicron is not quite as strong, and hence you don't lose your sense of smell as overtly as with the earlier variants. But because of that, it's more transmissible, and that, you know, and hence, you know, it spread dramatically across the globe. And so that'll be interesting. I mean, we'll see what emerges from that. The studies will be quite interesting.
Yeah. And I also guess, well, what we should learn at some point whether getting vaccinated changes the equation, whether you're less likely to see this effect.
Absolutely. I think that's a very good point as well, you know, and we're in the midst of studying that as well, is how vaccination status affects. I mean, it's clear that the vaccines reduce the risk of severe symptoms, and COVID in people that get infected, but how that it impacts also the sense of smell.
Well, there's a lot to learn here, and I think it's important to remember that COVID affects different people in profoundly different ways. So some people got over it really quickly or didn't even know they had it, and other people are living with symptoms that have gone on for well over a year, and that can include something called brain fog, which involves difficulty concentrating and memory problems, as well as insomnia, fatigue, and mood disorders. I'll be talking about that more in future episodes, and I think it's really important that scientists keep studying long COVID, and doing that might have other benefits, including helping scientists understand things like chronic fatigue syndrome, which is also associated with viral infections, and maybe also will shed some light on Alzheimer's disease.
Thank you for listening to Follow the Science. Follow the Science is produced by Faye Flam. You can follow Faye on Twitter at Faye Flam. That is FAYEFLAM. Today's episode was edited by Seth Glicksman, with music by Kyle Imperator. If you liked today's episode, we'd really love it if you left us a positive rating and review wherever you listened. Thanks in advance, and we'll see you next week.